Okay, here we are, class 3, session 10, and today we go back to the beginning. We go to the first few pages of the first TSK book. And in preparing for class this week, I did have the thought that I probably should have assigned the first few pages. I think I was trying to reduce the reading load. And so I only assigned pages 6 through 10, but I'm actually going to refer to a couple of things from the pages before that. But I think we'll be fine. So if we start at page 6, which is the reading for this week, the question that gets asked after that break on the page is what is space? And, you know, it's interesting to try to think yourself back to, or try to imagine, you know, you're reading this book and none of the other books have been written, and you're at the very beginning, you really don't know what to expect. So we start with the question, what is space? And then Rinpoche gives an answer and moves on. But before I talk about his answer and talk about what's presented here, I want to make a point that does go back to the previous page, page 5, where Rinpoche says something that will sound familiar because the same theme came up a few weeks ago in the first full paragraph on page 5. He's talking about the possibility of discovering new spaces. So this is a kind of starting point for the first book, and therefore you could say for the TSK vision. We're focused on space, and he says, you know, we really have possibilities that we haven't explored yet. We could discover new spaces. And then in this paragraph, he says, this idea of discovering new spaces may seem to be a purely abstract intellectual endeavor. So why would anybody want to do it, right, unless you happen to be a philosopher or a person who likes thinking about these things, and it's kind of a form of intellectual entertainment, I suppose you could say. And we had something very similar when we were reading in Dynamics, when the talk there was about challenging substance and identity. And of course, that's really talking about the same thing, because the reason that we are kind of focused, fixed on substance and identity is because in the kind of space that we ordinarily have access to, the only thing that counts is what has substance or identity. So we would like to be able to challenge that. That's what it says in Dynamics. And then he says, I don't have the exact language here, but he says, why would you want to do that? You know, why? In effect, he says, doesn't that seem too abstract? And he, the answer he gives is, we want to do it if we agree that the understanding that we currently enact, and I'm quoting now, the understanding we currently enact, if we agree that that doesn't serve our purposes, or if we agree that we are not conducting the lives that we would wish. So that is very closely related to what Rinpoche says here on page 5. He says, we have this deeply felt need to find an alternative to the sense of restriction and confinement which each of us experiences in our daily lives. And I think the formulation in Dynamics is in some ways easier to engage, because I could imagine somebody reading this and saying, reading what's in TSK, and saying, well, I don't feel a sense of restriction or confinement in my daily life. We don't need to argue that. It just somehow seems more immediately accessible to ask, Does our understanding serve our purpose? Are we conducting the lives we would wish? I think it's easier for people to look at that without trying to feel bad about things, but just say, well, no, there's a sense in which that's not true. So either set of questions is meant to lead to the same point. There is a reason. There is a reason for doing this. And the nature of that reason is, you could say, twofold. Let me get to that in a moment, actually. I want to make another point first. The point I want to make is, in both cases, Rinpoche says, you know, this is not just an abstract undertaking. We're not just having fun with ideas here. You know, that's not what TSK is about. It's not just intellectual. We have this felt need. We have a sense that we're not fulfilling our lives, not conducting the lives we would wish. It goes right to the heart of who we are. And I think that's a hard message to hear in some ways, because we have this view in the West of the intellectual realm as being somehow cut off from our real lives. I was trying to think about that a little bit over the last few days, and in some ways you can trace it back to a very old idea in Western thought. It goes back to Plato, and it had a very big impact, that you can divide the human spirit or mind into three parts. There's the intellectual part, there's the part that desires, that has appetites, and then there's the part that wills, that wants. Wanting is more like desires, but the part that is responsible for motivation. Right? And of course there are many variations, but that's a very old theme that you find in Plato. A very old way of understanding. And somehow, if you take that understanding, then it seems as though the intellect is the one that just, it's kind of like the computer, you know, it's like Dr. Spock. It just tries to decide what's reasonable, what's rational, without any concern for what it means to our lives. And so people are very ready to discard the significance of what seems to be only intellectual, or what seems to be only abstract. And so the natural response, or one way to respond certainly, is the way that Rinpoche responds here. He says, no, this isn't just abstract or intellectual, right? It's rooted in the things that matter to us the most, you know, our sense of restriction, or how we're conducting our lives. It's not just abstract and intellectual. But there are a couple of other things you could say about that, and I want to point this out, because so often people, if they start to read the TSK books, they do have this reaction. They say, oh, it's too intellectual for me. Of course, that's a whole other side. People feel very inadequate to dealing with the intellectual realm. That's different from rejecting the intellectual realm. Maybe it's the flip side. Very often people say, no, this, I don't care about this, it's just abstract, it's just intellectual, or I never really knew how to do this kind of thinking, so I can't deal with TSK. Right? I'm sure you've all heard that, maybe at different times you've even felt it. So one answer is to say, no, this isn't abstract and intellectual. Another answer might be to say, well, there's two other answers. One is to say, you know, we all have a view of the world. We all have an intellectual understanding of the world. It's just that we think, you know, we call our understanding the way things are. We don't feel as though we have to think our way into it. It's something we learn as we're growing up, and then it gets shaped through various influences. But in that sense, we're all living out a particular intellectual understanding of the world that is buried so deep. It's so deeply rooted in our way of making sense of the world that we don't think of it as a particular intellectual understanding, but it is. It absolutely is. And the problem, of course, is that we don't ever question it. Right? We don't realize that it could be different. And TSK is really about that. So that's a different way of approaching this. You can say, okay, don't worry, TSK isn't really intellectual. The problem with that, in a sense, is that, you know, on the surface, TSK is pretty intellectual. I mean, it does do a lot with words, a lot with reasoning, although you could discuss that more. Certainly, it presents ideas in a very that's very central to the presentation in the books, anyway. And those ideas are themselves meant to be a kind of contemplative practice. Lately, I've started using the word contemplative inquiry. We have creative inquiry, but lately I've started thinking about contemplative inquiry. And I think that that's a lot of what TSK does. So if you say, no, it's not intellectual, you have to challenge that understanding that says that the intellectual is about stuff we really don't care about. No, we do live our lives on the basis of our own understanding, and we'd have to challenge that. We have to be able to call that into question. So that's one answer. And then the second answer that is given in TSK, and it's presented especially, I think, in the next book in the series, Love of Knowledge, but also at the end of this book, is that is to say, no, you know, the abstract and the intellectual is not separate from the rest of our lives, and that, in fact, the way to bring about transformation is through developing a love of knowledge. Right? So we find ourselves talking about love at the end of this book, and it's the title of the next book. You know, it's like saying, okay, we get it that if you're going to be abstract and intellectual, if we're going to be abstract and intellectual, then that's not of any interest to anybody. But that would be the wrong approach. So Ken says here in the chat box, he says, we could say that we want our thinking to matter. Yeah, I think that's a very nice way of putting it. And of course, Rinpoche, you know, he's written a book called Mind Over Matter. And I don't think it's in that book, but somewhere he plays a lot with the word matter, you know, that something matters to us. And you know, the material world, matter in that sense, doesn't exactly matter. But mind matters, and our thinking should matter. I think that's exactly right. Thinking has this incredible responsibility, you could say, which is to make our lives matter in a new way. That thinking has the power to do that. You know, thinking, again, sometimes you say, well, thinking, that's just abstract, you know, that's just words, but we can think our way through a kind of contemplative inquiry into a different mode of being. And that, again, that's a way of thinking about what TSK is all about. So love of knowledge is really important. And in thinking about that, I thought, in a way, maybe the word love, I mean, the word love is an incredibly powerful word, but we have made it kind of cheap because we use it so often. That when we say love of knowledge, I'm not sure it has quite the power that it should have to communicate what not really what Rinpoche is saying here. I'm just kind of exploring this theme a little bit. But so I was thinking perhaps it makes more sense to talk about having a passion for knowledge. You know, we're passionate seekers of knowledge.
About this.
Thirst. Well, thirst is good. You know, all these words, passion and thirst, and I'm sure there are many others. The difficulty is they kind of go off in the direction of the emotions, you could say. That's not to say it's a... I mean, if you use the word, you know...
Put it out of reach.
Excuse me?
Say that. Thirst also tends to put it out of reach.
What puts it out of...
It's in the realm of desire.
Right. Yeah, it's in the realm... That's right. That's exactly right. It sets up a structure of desire when we talk about thirst. In the Buddhist tradition, this word craving, that's very important in Buddhism as a problem, is often sometimes translated as thirst as well. And yeah, it's... But I think you're right. The structure of desire means you're setting up something that will never be fulfilled. Now, the word passion, you could say, has that problem, too. The word passion literally, or not literally, say, but originally, meant more suffering. The word passion really means suffering. So in the Christian tradition, they talk about the passion of Christ, and that's the sufferings that Christ underwent in his last days on earth before he was crucified. So nonetheless, I think passion has somewhat the same sense, and it may help to remember that, after all, we have the word in English, compassion, with passion, to feel with someone else, which takes it a little bit out of this sense of my own craving, my own desires, even my own suffering. So to be passionate about knowledge. Love of knowledge is fine if you're willing to let yourself really feel what it's about. Caroline says devotion to knowledge. And devotion is a very nice word, actually. I was just reading something recently that talked about the difference between love and devotion, and basically said it's the same thing, but devotion is for something that you aspire to, or something that's higher than you. And it seems like that might be good, too. Although, again, we tend to use the word in somewhat too weak a way, you know, when we say, I'm devoted to whatever, that can be pretty weak. But the point here, whatever the word is, it needs to be strong. And it needs to motivate us. You know, the whole point with the inquiry that TSK is wanting to put in place is that we have this wish for activating a new vision. You know? And it's kind of built into the word vision, I suppose you could say, that there is love or devotion or thirst in the sense that Ken said. No, it wasn't Ken, I'm sorry. It was Hayward. And it needs to matter, that's what Ken said. So, yeah, somehow all of this really needs to matter. So the idea of discovering new spaces, you say, it's not just abstract, it's not just intellectual, it matters. So why does something matter? Well, basically there are two reasons why something matters to us. One is it opens up a new possibility, right? So if you look, let's see, I think it's on page 5 also. Let's see. Maybe not. I'll have to find it. Maybe on page 4. Okay, so one possibility is on page 5, and we've already talked about it, and that is this sense something matters to us because we have a sense of something missing or something that's painful. Right? Here he talks about restriction and confinement. So that's one possibility. That's sort of the negative side, you could say. And then the positive side, it's actually, and now I see it, to the very top of page 5 or the bottom of page 4, the positive side is to say, okay, so that paragraph starts off at the bottom of page 4, throughout history we have been maintaining a fixed and limiting focal setting without even being aware of doing so. And that's really the point that I wanted to make when I said that we all have our own philosophies. Here Rinpoche talks about that, basically talking about the same thing, I think, as saying we all have our own focal setting, our own way of perceiving and engaging the world. So, okay, we've been maintaining this. And then he says, if we become, this is the top of page 5, if we become able to change the setting, fantastic new knowledge and appreciation of life can be gained. So that's the positive side, right? So why would you want to activate this vision? Because we know that something fundamental is missing, or because we have a sense that something much more wonderful, let's say, is potentially available. Klaus puts this a little differently here in the chat box. He says, a TSK diet, knowledge as food. Yeah, there's a lovely line in the Dhammapada, which is a key text of the sayings of the Buddha, and he says something like, "We can learn to live on light. You know, we can learn to nourish ourselves with light, and that's not so different from what the TSK vision is about, because we are basically saying we can learn. I think that's exactly right, to nourish ourselves on knowledge." And maybe that's another way of talking about matter. You know, we can the substance. Well, I won't go there. That's too complicated and not worth it. Okay. So all that is by way of background. Let's start looking a little bit here. First of all, what I just quoted on page 5. It says we need to find an alternative, right? Now remember, we're just at the beginning of the vision, right? We're reading here, and it's very interesting. It's like you go back. It's like, let's say you've read a novel, or maybe you've seen a movie, and you really love it, and then you go back and you read it again, or you see it again, and it's got this tremendous richness to it, because now when you're at the beginning, you see certain themes being established, or certain, let's just say themes being established, that that are going to become more and more important. In other words, you're reading it with an appreciation for everything that's come later, and that appreciation gives a richness to the beginning. And I think in a way, when you go back and read the first TSK book, and then you see that everything you've worked with the vision in some way, that is, gives you something tremendously rich. So here at the beginning, Rinpoche writes that we want to find an alternative to the sense of restriction and confinement, and you could say the whole of the TSK vision, all the different books, or now we're talking about the space aspect, it's all about that. It's all about finding alternatives. So we've been looking at things about, challenging substance. That's we have a substance-centered view, and an alternative is to challenge that, or looking behind zero, some of the things we've been looking at lately, or this lovely line from last time about punching a hole in the fabric of existence, So all of that kind of remains to be worked out at this point in the TSK book, but the possibility is already being raised. Okay, so now if we go to the reading, we want to look at we want to look at this question that we started with, and then I went on this rather long description. Oh, I'm sorry. I needed to say, I need to go back and look at what a couple of people have said. So Michael says, aspiring to open TSK to a wider range of people, could we try to open to a wider range of knowing, to include any kind of interest, passion, hope, honest and caring involvement in life and the world? It seems that the truth that we are all guided by something and all limited by the conditioning that guides us, could a wider appeal be made that could help others to see through their limits? But that might require a new language that speaks to and out of the ordinary. Well, I think, that's an inspiring possibility. It does seem to me that you always need to speak to people in terms that matter to them. If you try to convince them that what you have is important, but it doesn't, what you have to share, let's say, is important, but it doesn't connect with what they care about, you won't get anywhere. And so, yes, what you're describing here. What you're suggesting here is, what do people care about, and how could we raise the possibility of finding within their field of concern a different way of knowing, a different way of understanding? Yeah, I think that's a very good way to think about it. And as you say, it may require a new language, or at least a new way of investigating. It's you know, there are many, many steps. That's why we are still trying to find our way into that range of possibilities. Sudhi says, I like the Nietzsche quotation at the beginning of my essay about the mirror, right? The quote says something like, when we look in the mirror, we only see the things in the mirror, and when we look at the things in the mirror, we only see the mirror, and that's the history of Western thought. I don't really know what that means, but I think it's somehow very important. She says, that implies that lots of what we call ordinary knowledge is error and is not true. So love of knowledge could also be love of truth. Yes, it certainly could. But if you think back to that quote that we were looking at, in Dynamics, page 46, you remember he talks about truth. And he says, the problem is that we hold on to our truth. And that holding on is a distortion. So that reminds me of two things. These are important general topics, so I'm willing to take the time to work with them, I think, even though we haven't gotten very far with the reading for today. One is, the two things it reminds me of, one is a story. And some of you have heard me talk about these things because these are examples that I find helpful. There was an early 20th century author, he's not that well known anymore, who wrote a book called Winesburg, Ohio. And it's short stories about people who live in this town called Winesburg, Ohio. And in the preface to the book, he says something like, everybody at some point in their lives gets hold of a truth. And then they hold on, they cling to that truth, and it distorts them because they're so busy clinging to that truth, holding on to it, that it kind of ties them in knots, you could say. And I think that's the danger of truth. So I think knowledge is a little different from truth in that way. But of course, if you understand truth in a certain sense, then yes, absolutely. And the other thing it reminds me of is another quotation from Nietzsche that I never get quite right because I like my version better than his, but it's very close to what he says, which is, truth is the grimace on the retreating face of falsehood. So when you're caught in a distorted understanding, there is something about that distorted understanding where if you look carefully, you see the distortion. And that insight into the distortion, that's the truth. And that would be a nice way to look. Okay, those are all lovely themes. And I don't now mean lovely in the sense of, you know, aesthetically pleasing, which would be one way to say that's what happens when an idea is just abstract. I mean lovely in the sense, excuse me, lovely in the sense that they invite transformation. Their beauty invites transformation. Okay, so I'm going to have us do just a quick little exercise. I was actually going to have us do two short exercises today, but let's at least do this first one and see if we have time for the second. And it's just presented. It's presented as a kind of a thought, a reflection. Again, it's actually before the reading. So I apologize for that. But he's talking about space, and at the very bottom of page 5, he says space is not only above and beyond us, space is also within us and surrounds us. Objects are never really frozen solid. There is space, room for activity, both in and around all objects. And so they move, even in existing. Well, that's a very interesting thought. Space is what lets objects move, and they do move, even in existing. And I just happened to be reading something. It's because of, you know, the email lists that I subscribe to. I happened to be reading a review of a book about Aristotle's idea of being, and I'm certainly not going to go into it too much, but one of the points he makes is that the word that we translate as substance, the Romans translated the Greek word ousia as substance, and then it becomes this thing, right? This very solid thing. And Rinpoche is saying here, things are not, you know, are not things. Appearance is not things, and that should be a theme that's very familiar to us right now with the work we're doing. So appearance is not things. Why? Because there's always room for activity, both inside and around all objects. And the point that this review, or this book was making, the reviewer mentioned, is that instead of translating the Greek as substance, it's better to translate it as activity. Interesting. Huh? So, maybe related here, but maybe not. It's just, sometimes, to me, it's very helpful to think that there are resources within our Western tradition that could help us understand more clearly what has tended to become covered over as we get used to a particular way of thinking. We think we know what we're talking about, but we don't. It gets covered over. So maybe here, in any case, Rinpoche is pointing towards that. Things are not frozen solid. There is space or room for activity both inside and around all objects, and so they move. It's a very interesting point. I don't know that it comes up anywhere else in the TSK books. Caroline points out that if you think of substance as activity, and now that I've brought that up, I'm going to have to go back and look at the review. I may be misstating it a little bit, but I think it's basically right. Substance as activity better links space to time. Yes, it does. And so does this quote, right? There is space. What is space? It's room for activity, right? Because there is space, and this comes up in the TSK books, time can generate, you could say maybe, can generate appearance. Here Rinpoche is starting in on this point, which I think is a very challenging point for, again, if you say the very beginning of the TSK vision. He's saying there's space, there's room for activity, and so things or objects move. Where do they come from? Where are they? Where do they go? It seems the answer, again, is space. And then he gives this little reflection for us to do, and I thought we could just do it for a couple of minutes and see if it leads us somewhere. You know, the point is that sometimes when we just talk, you know, and we talk and we're trying to point to something and we keep spinning out more words and we're always trying to point, and then sometimes we'd like to just stop talking, although the mind doesn't easily do that, and just reflect, let's say. Not talk, but reflect. So that's what he says here. He says, where do objects come from? Where are they? Where do they go? It seems the answer, again, is space. Look around you and contemplate this. Let your perception be drawn out. So this is not like an argument. It's just letting perception expand. Let your perception be drawn out by the associations which are given to the ordinary term space. So let's take a couple of minutes, to let our perception be drawn out, contemplating the availability, the presence, the inherent centrality of space. Let's do that for a couple of minutes. Okay. So let's come together and see if that little reflection was helpful in any way. Just let us know. Let me know. No, let us know. I will say a little something while I try to get the chat box back. Let's see. And that is, okay, where are you? Chat box. There. Okay. I will say a little something, which is, what I was reflecting on, letting my thoughts be, my perceptions be drawn out, I guess, by the associations with the word space. Well, I was especially trying out this new association, which says that space gives objects room to move. It lets them be active. Sudhi says something similar here. She says, associations to space, room, flexibility, not rigid. And I suppose where I was going was, just adding on to that, was not closed down, not fixed, not the only possibility. Sometimes you feel, I'm going to say something very strong, I think stronger than I mean, but it's because I mentioned the Passion of Christ, you know. You can almost feel crucified. Let's say that's way too strong. But, you know, reality presents itself and it freezes you into a particular posture and a particular response. And if space allows activity, if there's room for activity, so that whatever appears is in movement, it's a very different quality. Okay, Eliana says, with me the same. So, when I let perception wander, in some way there's less density and more space, and the movements of mind are more clear. Yeah, that's a very good point, because the mind moves, and that was part of what struck me in this too, is that the mind is subject to all of these same qualities or concerns, and when you see the mind moving, instead of just being sucked into where the mind has moved, let's say, then there's more clarity. So Ken brings us down to earth in a very nice way, I think. He says, I was reminded that this room has windows, and I relaxed into a smile. Yes. Yes, we don't have to come to the profound does not necessarily showing up a label that says profound. It may be that relaxing into a smile is enough. But Klaus adds some other thoughts, some other associations, as the chapter says, wholeness, completeness, connectedness. And Michael says, in your essay on space, projecting space into space, you look at experience as our connection with all kinds of space. Since experience is never still, how could it be a way of contacting anything fixed, substantial, and immobile? The notion of substance cannot be the harvest of experience, but a way of ignoring it. So that's very nicely put, Michael. I might say it a little differently, but I mean, you're pointing towards something really important, and that is, it seems to me that when we have an experience, we do it from a particular point, a starting point, and that starting point, we freeze that. We don't think of ourselves as experiencing the starting point. That's the basic idea of the bystander, right? Or you could say the outside stander. But something is fixed and solid, and that's just what makes experience possible. But in fact, I mean, that's how we see it. In fact, that sense of something being fixed and solid is a part of the experience, right? But by making it fixed and solid, as you say, Michael, we ignore it. Okay. Okay, let's make one more general point and then see if we can say something about the reading. What we just looked at, the approach we just looked at, asked us to look at objects. And it said, within and around, inside and around all objects, there is space, and that means that the objects are not fixed, right? They're not substantial. They can move. Everything is moving. And that's a very useful way in, and I think, we have enough background, it seems to me, that we could, we get a sense of that. But it's actually, and this is something that struck me, and I may be wrong about this, but it struck me when I was reading these few pages, it struck me as something about the way that the first TSK book proceeds. What I would say is that we don't usually just encounter objects. What we encounter is a meaningful world. And that's something that I do go into that space projecting space essay. I do talk about that in there. So the first book doesn't focus on that. In the later books, it does. The notion in Love of Knowledge, for instance, about the story, the founding story. Or, we've looked at so many things, the field communique, the temporal order, the logos. All of these things are talking about the whole. But it seems to me the first TSK book starts off from the individual object. And the reason it does that, but so now I'm just speculating, but it seems to me that when that first book was written, Rinpoche was really trying to open a dialogue with the scientific view of the world. You might say with scientists, that may be true, but with the scientific view of the world. And in science, you start from the idea that there is matter and there are solid objects, and Rinpoche is trying to open it up, you could say deconstruct it, right? And that's difficult, because that way of viewing the world doesn't exactly square up with our experience of the world. It squares up with a scientific understanding. So if I'm right about this, as I say, this is really speculation, but if I'm right, that Rinpoche is trying to open a dialogue with science, then science is abstract. We were talking about abstraction before, and science definitely, sort of aims to abstract, to pull out the literal meaning, to pull out what can be measured from experience, and then proceed on that basis. And it's difficult to have that conversation have a meaningful conversation with, when your partner in the conversation, science, is intent on not paying any attention to what's meaningful. So it's very challenging what the first book does, and I think that has tremendous strengths, but it also is particularly challenging. And I think the later books do it a little differently. Okay. Let's see now if we can say a little bit about the reading. I want to point to one area that might be a little confusing. We only have a few minutes, so I'll try to highlight a couple of things. One is that he starts off on page 6 by saying, well, if you wanted to define space, you could say that space is what makes room for objects. But then he says, that's a problem because space, as we usually think of it doesn't do anything. So how can you say that space makes room, right? Well, in fact, we talk a lot about that. I mean, in the TSK books, there's a lot of talk about space allowing or accommodating. Not so much the language of making room, because that's a kind of problematic way of talking about it. But the same idea, when we say space accommodates, isn't that an action? And the answer is no. Because if you go back up to the quote at the top of page 6, you know, he says, because there's space, there's room for activity. And so there are objects that act, that move. But space itself doesn't move. Space itself is not an actor. Because in order for there to be an actor, there has to be space. That's the point that's made at the top of page 6. And the kind of making room activity, the accommodating activity, from an ordinary point of view, that's a non-doing. Space makes it possible for actions to take place. Space is not an actor. That point is worth exploring in terms of what he goes on to say, where at the bottom of page 6, he's raising this question: can you say that space can be separate from objects? Can you say that it needs objects to exist? These are questions that come up when people say, "Well, let's look at this philosophically." You know. That's a question that gets asked a lot about space, and would be asked about TSK if someone were coming at it in that philosophical mode. If you stay with this idea that space is not an actor, it's not on the same level as objects. It's not like there's, you know, object A, object B, object C, and in that same list there's space. No, space is at a different level. Space is, it's more fundamental. So it's a little tricky to try to talk about whether you can separate space from objects, and whether you can say that there is no space in itself, which he seems to say here. Right? That space, in some aspects, can't be defined in isolation from objects. All that gets worked out, and I'm not going to try to say more because I don't have the opportunity. I do want to make the point that even in these very first few pages about space, we immediately talk about space in a way that's more fundamental than just physical space. Right? He says, the point I'm wanting to make here is that we bring in the mental realm. It's not just physical space. You know, he says about 5 lines up on page, from the bottom of page 6, the seeing of the objects and the space also occurs in a kind of space. Right? So there's a mental space. The space in which seeing happens is also a space. I'm going to jump back again to page 5. Because he says something very similar when he's talking about focal settings. He says, if we employ new focal settings and see the way they work, we can come to an overall understanding, which is itself a kind of space. This understanding is a kind of space. And then he goes on to say, an understanding or vision, and of course this is very interesting because he's really saying, in what sense is TSK a vision of reality? An understanding or vision can itself be the revealing basis of all reality. Very interesting and worth reflecting on. So, some of the advice that Rinpoche gives is that space leads us beyond substance, and it lets us relax. That's the actual word he talks about. If we let go of objects, that means we let go of duality. And you might think here of what we call the big sky practice, right? TSK exercise 15. The formal name is a mountain retreat. just breathing in space, letting go of objects, right? He points out that that's not easy to do if you think of space in ordinary terms, because then it just falls into a kind of blankness, right? But, well, I guess the thing to say about that is what he says at the bottom of page 7. And again, this is a kind of exercise. We're not going to do it. We're out of time now. But he says, space by itself is difficult to attend to, right? Because we are used to looking for things, right? Any explanations ordinarily select something specific to look at. However, it would be helpful to try to reverse this emphasis temporarily and attend more to the significance of the presence of space. So notice he doesn't say attend more to the presence of space. That would be the kind of blankness, maybe. But what is significant about the presence of space? And that's similar to the exercise we did. So if we look at that, what is significant about the presence of space, especially when you understand, as he defines at the top of page 6, space as giving room for activity so that objects move. Even, by the way, he says, even in existing, simply for an object to exist is an activity. And that goes back to this idea, maybe substance is better understood as activity. Okay, I'm going to stop there. I'll say a little more in the orientation. Let's see, if I remember correctly, next week, we're still not back in dynamics. I think we go to sacred dimensions. Is that right? I'm not sure. But you will find out soon enough.
I like contemplative inquiry.
You like contemplative inquiry? Yeah, I'm trying to work with that, actually. Good, thank you.
Yes.
I'm glad to have that feedback. I'm actually... Ron Purser, I don't think Ron was here today, but Ron is organizing a conference in San Francisco in June. Basically, it's on mindfulness and compassion. But I'm actually going to give a couple of talks at that conference. And I want to introduce the idea of contemplative inquiry there.
So, great.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you very much, everybody. And we'll talk next week.
Okay.